This call is being recorded.
I want to thank everyone for joining us here today. If you are with the media and you have not yet announced yourself, if you would please do so now. We are going to place all attendees in listen-only mode, and we are recording this telepresser. So if you could please announce yourself and your outlet right now, that would be great.
This is Susan Salisbury at the Palm Beach Post.
Thank you, Susan. I know we have Andrew, we have Bruce, Mary Ellen. Is there anyone else on the call that has not announced themselves or been identified yet? We're just about to get going here. Okay, well, thank you for joining us today. My name is Jennifer Renix. I am the Director of Policy and Communications here for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and I'm facilitating today's brief telepress conference. We are highlighting, as you know, a new report that is assessing the feasibility of developing cooling towers to replace the antiquated and cooling canal system currently in use at Florida Power & Light's Turkey Point Power Plant. We're going to be joined today by three speakers. They're going to offer very, very brief statements, and we will leave plenty of time for question and answer. First is Dr. Stephen Smith, Executive Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Then Bill Powers of Powers Engineering and the author of this new report. And finally, Laura Reynolds, who is a consultant with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and former Executive Director of the Tropical Audubon Society. Attendees are going to be in listen-only mode, and we will open the lines for questions after. And now I'm going to turn this telepress conference over to Stephen Smith. Stephen?
Great. Thank you, Jennifer, and thanks, everybody, for joining. We'll try to be efficient and brief because we know your time is valuable. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is very pleased to share with you a report that we contracted with Powers Engineering and Bill Powers to look at. Bill has a great deal of expertise in looking at utility projects and energy projects from an engineering perspective. We've worked with Bill in other parts of our region on some issues like this. And when we got more involved in looking at Turkey Point 3 and 4, it was very clear to us that the cooling canal system that FP&L has operated for 40 years is truly unique. It is unorthodox, and it is failing. And when we filed our Clean Water Act lawsuit, we have begun to properly characterize this as an open industrial sewer that is unworthy of continued operation in relationship that it has to Biscayne National Park, the Everglades, the city of Miami, and the drinking water sources. And we've known for decades that this system is failing, that it is unlined, it is porous, and it is causing contamination both to groundwater, and now with increased monitoring that's been taking place over the last few years, we're seeing that it is also causing contamination to surface water, which is the source of our Clean Water Act lawsuit. What we have tried to do in a constructive way is to identify what is the underlying problem and what is a underlying and important fix to the underlying problem that can stop this from going forward. I want to clarify, much of the attention has been focused on how does FP&L remediate or deal with the mess, and they're proposing increasingly these heroic efforts of drilling extraction wells and trying to figure out how to pull water from other places and trying to do all these things to try to salvage this failed system. But the bottom line is we need to deal first and foremost. There's a classic saying that if you're digging yourself in the hole, the first thing you want to do is stop digging. And by continuing to operate these cooling canals, that is the underlying problem for this pollution that we're seeing both in Biscayne Bay and in the groundwater. Cooling, mechanical draft cooling towers are the best available technology fix. It is the norm. Any utility that is not discharging directly then once through cooling, anywhere in the world is using cooling towers. FP&L themselves have built cooling towers at the Turkey Point site for Units 5, and they are proposing cooling towers for Units 6 and 7. They are familiar with this technology. They use it at other facilities. There is absolutely no reason whatsoever why they cannot use this technology here and deal with the underlying problem once and for all and shut down this open industrial sewer. It's going to cost money, but it is a reasonable investment. They have made billions of dollars off these reactors since they've operated them. They've run them on the cheap, and they've caused significant pollution in the area. They need to clean that pollution up, but in the 21st century, we need to use best available technology to cool water and manage this. The way they're operating this open industrial sewer is unacceptable. So what I want to do is I want to turn this over to Bill Powers, let him talk to you a little bit about the research and the work he did for us, and then Laura will talk a little bit about the issues associated with water usage that are so critical in this scenario. So, Bill?
Thank you. Just a little on my background to start. I'm an education mechanical engineer, professional engineer's license, based in San Diego, California, and I've been a consulting engineer for the last 30 years or so. And over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of focus around the country on addressing issues of cooling system, water use, water discharge. And over the last decade or so, I've worked on a few different cooling system alternative studies for Plant Vogtle in Georgia, or the proposed Units 3 and 4, Indian Point outside of New York City in New York, Diablo Canyon in California, and also Turkey Point. And that point's well made that the FPL is already operating a large mechanical draft cooling tower at the site for Unit 5, which is a little over 1,000 megawatt gas-fired combined cycle plant. And the cooling tower that's operational there now, as well as the proposed cooling towers, the mechanical draft cooling towers for Turkey Point Units 6 and 7, served as the model for a cooling towers for Units 3 and 4. So in this case, obviously, FPL already considers mechanical draft cooling towers for new units at the site as best available technology. And best available technology in this case for addressing the canal cooling system would be displacement of that system with mechanical draft cooling towers for Units 3 and 4. And there are a number of operational retrofit cooling towers around the country that also served. And as you saw in the report, there's some photos of the cooling towers retrofit cooling towers at the Palisades Nuclear, which is that it's a single unit site in Michigan, but the size of that reactor is almost identical to the uprated size of Units 3 and 4 at Turkey Point. And another of Plant Yates in Georgia, a 40-cell tower, which does serve as the model for one of the possible configurations for Units 3 and 4. One of the issues that came up here was cost. If these reactors are going to retire in 2032 and 2033, it's going to take a few years to, even if we start tomorrow, it's going to take a few years before those cooling towers are operational. How much cost impact would the cooling towers have on rates? And as you may have seen in the report, overall impact on the energy charge in the range of about 1.5% to 2%. Energy charge is only about a third of a ratepayer's bill. So the overall impact on rates would likely be less than 1%. Assuming this is paid off on a 10-year financial life. Another issue that came up is, so if you get the green light or FPL gets the green light to pursue this, how quickly can they go from the green light to operational cooling towers? And my best professional judgment on that, if it is a priority, is in the range of 4 years. And the model for that is the most recent major cooling tower retrofit that's been done in the country, which is up at Brayton Point Station, a 1,500-megawatt coal plant, where they went from initiating permitting to operational cooling towers in a little over 4 years. And they had a more complicated situation there where they had to tie in pipes directly to the existing cooling system, which would not happen in this case. We'd be pulling from the discharge canal and returning cooled water to the intake canal for the unit. So there'd be a hands-off retrofit. And finally, this issue of what to do with cooling towers produced some level of wastewater themselves called blowdown. What to do with the blowdown and what would be the universe of sources of water to make up the evaporation in those cooling towers. And the challenge for me was to look at a single source of makeup water, which is reclaimed water from the South District Wastewater Treatment Plant. And there is one operational nuclear plant in the country, Palo Verde out in Arizona. It's the largest nuclear plant in the country, 3,900 megawatts, that is exclusively relied on reclaimed water as its source of makeup water for over 30 years successfully. And the way they do that is rely on reclaimed water and have ponds on site or reservoirs to provide them with a reserve of 2 or 3 weeks of water should anything happen with the production of that reclaimed water at, in this case, for example, South District. And that has served now as the model in this report or a makeup water system that is exclusively using reclaimed water and concentrating it sufficiently so that a reasonably priced recovery system called a zero liquid discharge system can be utilized to eliminate the need to discharge wastewater from those cooling towers. So there would be no need to inject that discharge below ground or to deal with it in any way other than return the water in that wastewater as a purified stream for makeup water and have a solid waste that would need to be discharged from that zero liquid discharge system. So that's an overview of the results of the report.
Great. Thanks, Bill. And so let me turn it over now to Laura Reynolds, who is consulting with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and her comments.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I think the thing to focus on here, at least for South Florida, is that the environmental community has been looking for real abatement to the source of pollution. And we have found, you know, we waited 120 days looking for DEP to put forward a comprehensive solution and real abatement. And instead, we found that the language in their consent decree really recycled Miami-Dade's agreement, their earlier agreement, and had some the language of their administrative order that even a judge found inadequate. So what this offers to us is a real solution vetted by an expert that allows us to remove the interactions of the open industrial sewer, not only with our sole source aquifer, but with Biscayne National Park, and it removes the perpetual demand on water and salt loading. Now, the salt loading is up to 3 million pounds of salt daily. Now, Dade County is looking for ways to become more resilient. We're looking for ways to restore Everglades and Biscayne National Park, and this is in direct conflict with that. And so this solution offers a way to abate the source of pollution, move forward, and it's a win-win for Dade County because they're currently looking for a use of 117 million gallons a day of reuse water. They're under a mandate that by 2025, they have to recycle that much water. And so 2 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, FPL went to Miami-Dade County and officially suspended their use of 90 million gallons of reuse water for 6 and 7. They met with Doug Yoder and Bertha Goldenberg at Miami-Dade Water and Sewer and said, we will not need your water. This will be delayed until 2031, 2032 timeframe. And that doesn't put them in compliance for their reuse water demands. And so we're offering a solution that not only tackles the issue of salt loading and moving the saltwater intrusion line and protecting Everglades restoration efforts, which points to resiliency in Miami-Dade County, we're also offering a way to recycle Miami-Dade's water to stay in compliance with the 2025 mandate. Now, FPL has stated publicly several times, this is too expensive, it's not feasible. In fact, they did a feasibility study some time ago where the only reason they dismissed this option was cost. And so you heard Bill Power say, this can be done in 4 years. And, the cost of it is not as staggering as anyone would think. And I can't remember those figures right now, but it's definitely not as high as remediating this plume without actually abating the plume. In other words, if you're only dealing with just remediation, you're going to continue to see the pollution loaded into the environment, and you will have to deal with that at a later date. So this offers a solution that really is all-encompassing and is a win-win.
Great. Well, thank you, Laura. So in summary, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy in a Responsible Way has put forth into the public discord a positive, well-researched solution to the underlying problem of this open industrial sewer that is causing all these issues in Biscayne Bay National Park, in the Everglades, in the groundwater, threatening the groundwater. We've offered a responsible solution to help deal with the wastewater issues that Miami has, and it can be done in a cost-effective manner, in a timely manner. It is best available technology, and it gives FPL an opportunity. FPL and their parent company, NextEra, brag so much about being the cleanest, greenest utility in the country and how they are the best, use the best technology, how they're cutting edge. Well, here they are running an open industrial sewer. They know what technology can fix this problem once and for all, and they, in the typical fashion, in a bullying way, want to attack people who bring good solutions. They want to attack and say it's going to be too expensive, it'll take too long, can't be done. And what we've done here is shown in very methodical way that not only can it be done, this is the norm everywhere else in the world. This is what utilities do when they need to cool water. They do not have 10 square mile open industrial sewers that leak into the groundwater and leak into surface water. So with that, let me stop and encourage folks to ask clarifying questions or any questions you have. We're eager to hear from you.
And we have now, thank you, Steve and Bill and Laura, we have opened the lines and we have taken everyone off mute. And I'd just like to remind you, our priority, of course, is for the media to ask the questions here. And when you do ask your question, please state your name and your outlet along with your question so we can be sure that we follow up if necessary. So please go ahead.
This is Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald. I wanted to ask about the four-year time frame here. It seems to me that while you say it's efficient amount of time, isn't there some criticism that others may mount for this taking so long when the problem, as everyone has indicated, is encroaching, the saltwater plume is encroaching on the drinking water source more quickly than 4 years. So why is 4 years a good option?
Well, let me just take a quick stab at that, and then I'll let others follow up. Their current remediation plan takes 10 years and doesn't stop the movement of the plume at the base of the plume. It only deals with the plume sort of in the center. And so the plan that's currently on the table doesn't solve the problem at all. What we're proposing is that, they move forward with their remediation plan. However, and I know that Dade County recently met with FPL, and they've rejected portions of that plan. And that's something you should follow up with DERM about. you know, what sections of that are problematic. But having said that, we reviewed not only the model, but all of the information that DEP and FPL provided, and we have a vote of no confidence. And so here's a plan that takes 4 years that is going to stop, actually abate the pollution source, where their plan doesn't actually stop it in 10 years. And so I think if you were to combine both of these, you end up not only removing, or at least removing portions of the pollution in the groundwater, but you also stop future loading. So yep. The pollution that's in the ground right now has to be dealt with. And in addition to that, we're saying let's not put any more in the ground.
Yeah, Mary Ellen, this is Stephen. I want to emphasize, it is one of the things is it's just a very sad statement on the fact that FPL knows that this technology is the best technology. They should have implemented this a long time ago. But we're at a point in time now where FPL is going to attempt to run Turkey Point 3 and 4 at least for another 17 years, and will likely ask for a license extension for another 20 years beyond that. Now, we'll see whether the NRC grants it. In the proceedings I think you covered and others have covered that are on this call, they basically wouldn't even do a feasibility study for the Public Service Commission this year on Turkey Point 6 and 7. Laura told you that they delayed even acknowledging to Miami-Dade that they may be needing the wastewater until into the 2030s. Whether they build 6 or 7 or not, they're going to operate 3 and 4, and it's very likely they're going to operate 3 and 4 for a long time. What we're proposing stops the problem going forward. What it doesn't do, although it helps, but it doesn't fix the mess they've made. And so this is one of the things that needs to be differentiated in the discussion, because FPL continues, and a lot of the regulatory wrangling is you've got this plume that's migrating towards the drinking water wells, as you've identified. You've got the contamination in the surface water. You've got a big mess, and that mess has to be remediated. But the problem is nobody is asking and going back to the source and saying, how do we get here, and how do we stop adding to the problem? What we're proposing is that portion of the fix. You've got to stop adding to the problem. You've got to deal with the best technology. And then it opens up options, new ways to deal with remediation when you're not adding more salt loading, as Laura said. So is 4 years long enough? I think it's what is required in order to get this thing, get these towers built. Is it going to, do we need to stop the remediation and wait for these towers to be built? Absolutely not. But there's no reason to propose a remediation when you don't deal with the underlying problem. And that's the piece that is so frustrating to us that's missing. And so that's why, yes, 4 years, we wish it would be faster. Yes, they need to deal with the groundwater contamination simultaneously, but they've got to fix the underlying problem.
And let me just add, I think everybody on the phone knows this, but Dade County passed a resolution this month that calls for the closure of the cooling canal system by 2033. And so this is in line with that solution. Also, whatever the load is for Miami, these mechanical draft cooling towers and the investment in that can be used for either the 20-year license extension, a future 6 and 7, or a new gas plant, whatever they decide to build on site, this could be retrofit for that.
Other questions?
This is Sarah Barzak. Bill, could you just comment on the 4 years question, because you had some excellent examples in your report?
Well, part of it is just the nature of doing a major construction project. One, they will require approximately a year just to go through the preparation of a plan and get an initial permit approved so that they can then move into the construction stage. And these are large physical devices, and it takes a certain amount of lead time to get the equipment and stage the construction to make it happen. And that's just a reality of a major construction project.
Hi, this is Andrew Smith with S&P Global Market Intelligence. I'm not really too sure on where things currently stand with the plume. You were mentioning how it's a threat to the drinking water, and I believe you said that it's encroaching upon it within the next 4 years. Could you elaborate on currently where things stand with that plume?
I can answer that. The plume is continuing to move in all directions and is at least 4 miles off site in every direction. It hasn't been documented completely on the east side, and we think it's a lot farther on the east side. However, it hasn't stopped moving. Because the ionic concentration is much higher in the plume than anything else, it moves faster than the surrounding groundwater. And so it's consuming 1,000 acres of future potable water supply every single day.
This is Mary Ellen again, and I wanted to follow up on a point Mr. Powers made. When you're in your comparison, I think it was to the Arizona plant, where you talked about how they use reservoirs of ponds with reclaimed water, and that provides them like a 2 to 3 week supply. Now, is that something that is feasible to have that kind of groundwater storage area that FPLNL could use at this particular site? How would that work?
There is one of the figures, Mary Ellen, in the report, I think it's figure 13, has a location sites for a couple of reservoirs. And what it would, the recommendation is to, there is one, in fact, these cooling towers would be located around a cul-de-sac of canals that were never incorporated into the active cooling canal system. And my recommendation is utilize that cul-de-sac canal system as reservoir one, and not, this wouldn't be groundwater storage, these would be surface reservoirs. One would be utilizing that cul-de-sac as one reservoir and then isolating about 60 acres or so of the existing cooling canal system as a second reservoir, just isolate it as a reservoir for applying that reserve if it's needed.
And if you were to isolate it, what do you mean by that? Does that mean you put liners in so it prevents leaking? What do you mean?
Well, leaking wouldn't be an issue. This would be very high-grade water. So this isn't a salinity issue. This would be water with almost no dissolved salts in it. So leakage of this water wouldn't be an issue. It could be lined in order to prevent leakage, though there's sufficient rain makeup in this case that I'm not sure that would be necessary, though it could be done either way. They have, what they've done when they dug these canals 40 years ago is they've got berms of material that separate the different canal channels, and that one option for them is to continue to move that stored material to isolate that portion of the canal system as a reservoir. So it could be done, at least in theory, it could be done quite simply by moving dirt, not dirt, but rocky limestone type material that the canals have been cut in.
So Mary Ellen, just to follow up on that, one of the issues in 6 and 7 were the radial collector, what I call the largest well field constructed in the area for 125 million gallons a day. That has been shown to have a deleterious effect on groundwater flow to Biscayne. And so this helps alleviate the usage of that. I don't know if you remember that issue from before, but pulling the groundwater out of the aquifer is not ideal. And so this helps with a backup source, even if there's issues bringing the recycled sewer water to the plant site.
But that, let's just be clear, that the water that we're proposing to come to the site would be treated. It would not be, it's not raw sewage by any means. It's been treated numerous times. And so the Palo Verde, Bill, you may want to share about the largest nuclear plant in the country, and it is effectively using a similar system, and there's been no problems whatsoever with that.
Right, and I'll back up one additional step, which is in the application that FPL filed for Turkey Point Units 6 and 7, they had identified a site on the property to further treat water coming from the South District Wastewater Treatment Plant. And if you were to look on page 20 of this report, there's a figure 12 and a 13. And in both of those figures, that site has been incorporated for further water treatment and to completely address the biological agents in that water, and also to remove any materials in that water that could lead to scaling in the cooling towers. In order for this zero liquid discharge system to be cost reasonable, the water being used has to be capable of being highly concentrated, as it is done out at Palo Verde, to minimize the waste stream that comes off the cooling towers. But the water that would go into those reservoirs would have gone through all of this treatment, and it would be a purified form of water in those storage reservoirs.
So let me just add, cost estimate include those, the cost of that treatment and cleanup, or is that something that is borne by the county because it's wastewater?
That's a good question. The cost estimate is in the report. There is a cost estimate for the zero liquid discharge system and the reclaimed water. And that, however, that cost has not been assumed by me to be borne by FPL. The costs are in the report, but they're not included in the cooling tower cost estimate that's shown in that executive summary.
Now, for 6 and 7, Miami-Dade County agreed to bear the cost of bringing tertiary treated water to the site, and then FPL would remove the nutrients, the additional nutrients, or anything that would be problematic in scaling, as Bill mentioned. And so a similar agreement could be entered into by the county and FPL, but we did not assume that here because it's an unknown at this point. But knowing that they need to recycle this water by 2025, it looks like this would be a large project option for them.
Yeah, and Mary Ellen, that's an important point. I mean, the Miami-Dade County has to do something. They can't continue to do what they're doing. And so this is kind of a win-win. It helps with the problems at Turkey Point, and it also helps with Miami-Dade. And given the valuable, critical nature of fresh water in South Florida, we need to be very smart about how we use it and how we minimize it and how we recycle it. And this is very important.
And I'll just add one more win-win to this scenario. As part of the Biscayne Bay Coastal Wetlands, 90 million gallons a day of reuse water was earmarked for the project. That can still happen, and happen even easier as a result of this project, because it will be brought to the location where it's needed for the project. And the piece that's missing now, we have a remediation piece, we have an abatement piece. We're also looking for mitigation for the damages to Biscayne Bay. So providing makeup water for the Biscayne Bay Coastal Wetlands Everglades Restoration Project would be that additional third rung that could come out of a project like this.
Other questions? Well, if anybody has any further questions, we're happy to answer them. We know that the report has a lot of information in it. Bill is available. You know, if you have any more questions now, we're eager to work with you to help put forward reasonable and responsible solutions. Again, I want to emphasize that this is meant to engage with FPL in a constructive way. As Laura said, the city passed a resolution wanting to see these cooling canals shut down. We support that. We think it can be shut down a lot sooner than 15 years from now. We think that FPL knows how to do this. They've done it at Unit 5. They've proposed it for 6 and 7. This is what I would call a no-regret strategy. No regrets in the sense that by building these cooling towers and hooking them up to 3 and 4, whether they go forward with 6 and 7, whether they build an additional natural gas plant because 6 and 7 is too costly, now somewhere north of $24 billion and climbing, whatever they build, these towers can be used for, they may have to be slightly modified for the particular plant, but this is an investment that we know, given the size of Miami and the fact that people are going to continue to use electricity, this is a way to assure that whatever type of generation is built, that we're doing the best available technology. The other thing that I want to quickly mention is that FPL will not have to shut Turkey Point down while they build these towers. They can continue to operate it, and then when they do the final hookup, they can hook it up during a refueling outage. So the notion that somehow another Turkey Point is not going to be able to provide power while this is being done is simply false, because other examples of this, they have been able to run the plant and build this in parallel, and then when they actually get into the actual interconnection, because nuclear plants have to be brought down every 18 months or so for fuel reloading, you can time the hookup to that so that you minimize the downtime for the facility. So again, gets at the underlying problem, helps with the water issue, basically stops adding to the problem, can be done in a cost-effective, a timely way, and it basically allows FPL to have a no-regret strategy going forward for dealing with this issue. So let me just ask one more time if there's any additional questions people may have.
I actually did have one follow-up.
Sure.
So what is your next step with this? Is this just out there for FPL to read the media and see, or are you actually going to present this to Miami-Dade or FPL? What's your next step?
Absolutely. So we have met with FPL. We discussed this in their typical arrogant bully fashion. They completely dismissed it and, you know, tried to communicate to us that we just didn't understand and don't know what we're talking about, which is absolutely false. But there are a number of decision makers that are really interested in finding a solution. So our next steps is to get this in front of and in the hands of decision makers. Our next step is to continually point out, as the information comes in about how the remediation is going to fail, that they're doing, that we're going to continue to hold this out as the fix, the piece of the puzzle that is missing. We're going to take this to local decision makers, state decision makers, federal decision makers. We have filed a federal Clean Water Act lawsuit. We believe that this is part of the remedy that ultimately needs to be dealt with. So we're putting this out in that context also. So there's lots of options. And again, contrary to the way FPL wants to characterize this, we're putting forward a thoughtful, reasonably well-researched document for the public discussion, and we're challenging the utility to put their money where their mouth is and not only talk the talk, but walk the talk. If they want to be a clean leader environmental utility, they need to be using best available technology, not running an open industrial sewer wedged in between two national parks. And so our intent is to keep the pressure on, hold this out as an option, demonstrate to people that even though FPL wants to say it's not possible, they're actually doing it at the site now. They're proposing it at the site in the future, and there's no reason why they can't use this for 3 and 4 and finally shut this open sewer down. So, yes, we're going to be very aggressive in holding this out as a viable option. Any other questions? Okay, well, I want to, again, personally thank you. Thank Bill for his good work. Thank everybody that's on the call. You know, if you have any follow-up questions, I think Bill is actually going to be on vacation for a few weeks, so we'll do the best we can to answer them as it goes on. We look forward to continue this discussion. You know, this isn't going to be fixed overnight, but by giving good, responsible options, we think it helps move the public debate forward in a responsible way. So we appreciate y'all's interest, and anything else we can do, let us know. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you all for attending, and if anyone has any additional questions or media queries, please don't hesitate to contact us through SACE's media line, which you're all familiar with, 865-235-1448, and the audio recording from this will be available on our website at cleanenergy.org as soon as possible. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.